Hi, it's Tuesday afternoon, and let me take a look at the current situation. I want to say a few words that's going on in the Middle East. By way of a general background, especially the subject of Egypt, I find interesting. This is being sponsored by two people, by Lee J. Lowenstein and family. Thank you very much. And by Brad and Brachy Kaufman. And Brad's doing in memory of all our holy IDF soldiers who have fallen in battle, with bravery and strength, live on in all Klal Yisrael. I myself is forever indebted to you for your ultimate sacrifice. Very well put, Brad. Okay, it's just interesting to me that I guess when I go online, you know, they get your algorithms and all that, and I get thrown all kind of stuff from Middle East and Arab world, especially because I try to follow what's going by the Arabs based on Damash and Toshib and so forth. And, you know, there's a lot of things that appear in public, but the real stuff is happening behind the scenes. You understand? So it's interesting to me that recently there was a regime change, as we all know, in Syria. And the old regime was overthrown. And now you have a new one in. It's a little funny which way it's heading. And that's one bit border of Israel. That's in the north, of course. And it seems to be, as far as I can tell, that, you know, the government has been taken over by jihadists of one sort or another. Although the top guys are being very guided by Westerners. Seems like British to me, as far as I can see. So notice this is part of plots. And affects Israel, of course. We're hoping, I've been saying for a long time now, that hopefully this government will make peace with Israel. I don't know if that's going to happen, but it's within the realm of possibility, only because they said it. Like I mentioned last time, it doesn't make sense that you have all these jihadist fanatics, you know. They're super Islamists, but they seem to be bent, meanwhile, on trying to get rid of, exterminate all the minorities in Syria, and then once they have one big Sunni state, then they'll go after Israel. Kach nearly. But the other one's Egypt, which is actually a much bigger threat to Israel, but Egypt is a very funny case, because Egypt really, really hates Israel. She'en kamoho. Boy, do they hate Israel from top to bottom. And boy, would they love Israel went down. Oh my goodness. But international events, the Ribbono Shel Olam has so run the world and so arranged the chessboard that they cannot indulge this. And on the contrary, they have to sort of be good to Israel and help Israel in certain ways. For example, it's very twisted and complicated. I just want to unpack some of this, if I can. Try and make it a little bit clearer to people, to the best of my ability. If you saw, not long ago, there was supposed to be a big march. People coming from all over Europe and the Middle East to go to Egypt and then walk, then drive to the Sinai Desert, and then walk the last 50 miles or so, or 40 miles, to Gaza, and make a whole big stink on Hululu. And I'm sure that Hamas was hoping this would happen, and this would somehow or other force the border open to Gaza and enable them to get reinforcements and food and who knows what. But it did not happen, okay? And the reason it did not happen is because the government of Egypt stopped it. They said, we weren't consulted, we weren't asked, and we don't give permission, and get out of here. And those people who came to the country, you probably saw it online, those of you who follow the news in the Middle East, the Egyptians met them at the airport and turned them around. And those who are trying to walk across North Africa and walk into Egypt from the Libyan border, in other words, North Africa goes from west to east, from left to right. You got Morocco, then Algeria, and then Tunisia, and then Libya, and then Egypt. So they want to walk in those countries all the way up to Egypt, and Egypt has not let them in. Okay? And this has led, among other things, I mean, whoever thought this up was doing this to embarrass Egypt. And the other day, the spokesman for Hamas said, this is all Egypt's fault because they're not helping us, and so on and so forth. And there is a certain amount of truth to that, in the sense, as I said for 2 years now, I said this 2 years ago, that the Gaza Strip is going to be very different than the war in Syria had it broken out, or a war in Lebanon had it broken out. Now, Baruch Hashem, Israel was able to do the pager business and the other stuff with the Hezbollah, so it didn't happen, not yet. But if they had a war, which was mamish open season, when Israel, you'd have jihadists flying in from all over the world, literally, including America, to join the holy war against Israel. I mean, that's how they operate over there. It's a good thing, Ribbono Shel Olam so arranged matters, that the Hezbollah, which is in the north, are Shiite Muslims that are considered kofrim by the Sunni Muslims, therefore the Sunnis didn't join them. But Iran, which is a Shiite, backs up Hezbollah and supplies them. They stopped it temporarily because of the Israeli attack, but I'm sure as we speak, they're going to do it again. So this is the problem Israel has. It's existential situation. And what do you do? And latest news is that Bibi said, we're going to go and try to take over all of Gaza, every single block, every single this, which means there's going to be a lot of casualties. And maybe they'll win. I don't know. It's, it seems very bad. On the other hand, I do hear the part that you can't let Hezbollah survive, because if they do, they won. They'll claim they won and they won't be wrong. And you won't get your hostages back and all this other kind of stuff. And what can I tell you? It's going to be a tough situation. Now, Egypt is very interesting in all this, because Egypt's the biggest Arab country, and they sure as heck have the biggest Arab army. They keep their army fully stocked and with the latest weapons and all this kind of junk. I could take cock that ever since the last 2 years, I've been seeing things online by Israelis that say, oh, watch out for Egypt. They're building up their army. They're moving people into the Sinai and all this sort of thing. I don't know if it's true. There's so much falseness on the internet, so much fake news, that it's hard to get a hold of this. But I know a couple of basics which guide me in trying to judge the situation. The first basic is that Egypt is a funny situation because it's a giant, but it's very wobbly and clumsy, Dahainu. Egypt, when I was born, Egypt probably had 30 million people, and today they have 116 million, okay? So think about that, okay? Pi Shnayim, right? I mean, Pi Chamesh. What am I saying? No, it's three times as much, four times as much. Now, that's, and it's growing all the time. So they have the opposite of what you find in most countries around the world today, which is a negative growth, is a lack of babies. I'm sure you must have seen that in the USA. I'm talking about native-born babies. In Russia, in China, in Iran, believe it or not, in Japan, in Korea, one after another, in Europe, in the Western European countries, one after another, you see that the women don't have kids. And if they do, they have one or maybe two, ulai efsha two. And as I've said many times, just basic demographics, common sense tells you, in order to keep even, so you start with 10 million and don't go below 10 million, for example, you need everybody should have three, okay? Now, why three? Because it's really 2 point something. Let's say 2.3, 2.4. There's no such thing as 0.4 baby. Either you have another child or you do not. So if you just have two children, if everybody, without exception, has two children, you shrink. Does that make sense? Because it's not true that every single person has two kids. And some people can't have children. And some of these children die. And some of these children have what we call today special needs and things like this. So you can't exactly count them for contributing to the economy. And so, like I said before, I am far from being a professor in demographics. But common sense a little bit is not so hard. And you need that. So that's around the world. But in Egypt, it's the opposite. It's a baby boom, 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 boom. And it's catastrophic for Egypt because it's too many people and not enough food and not enough water. Okay? So Egypt's been struggling with this. That's why it's a giant, but it's clumsy. They would like to crush Israel. And they could say they have 120 million people almost. And they go and overwhelm Israel, all the rest of it. I'm sure they dream of that. But to put that into practice, it's not so possible because all these people are poor and illiterate. And hungry, and so on, and they're a drag on the system as opposed to a plus on the system. In other words, instead of saying, oh, we have 115 million people contributing to the economy, therefore we have a rich and powerful economy, we could afford to have a war with Israel and bring in tanks and airplanes and all that other kind of stuff. Instead, most of those people don't contribute to the economy, they're a drag on the economy, and the government, which hates to do this, has to spend the money giving them food. Plain and simple, oichel. You understand? Food. And it's not so simple with them. It's not so simple. And if you throw into that something I've mentioned many times, which is they all depend on the Nile River. And the Nile River is not Dabar Pasha at all, because it starts deep down south of Egypt in Africa, Central Africa. And those countries in there, like Abyssinia, like Ethiopia, Uganda, they say, we want more of the water, maybe we'll cut you off. In which case, Egypt drops dead. They simply don't have water. So you have 115 million people and they don't have water. That's an ugly situation. Now, why am I talking about all this? So they hate Israel, but the economics of it and the demography of it hobble their efforts to become a strong military power and sustain a war with Israel, simply because ever since they made a treaty back in the 1970s with Israel, a peace treaty, which Sadat did, and the Egyptians hated to do it. However, and I've made this point in the past also, they cannot deny that they got value for money. That's a fact. People can say today, as they do in the Arab world in Egypt, that Anwar Sadat, the president, was a traitor. He made peace with Israel. He didn't help out the Palestinians. He agreed that Israel should have this, that, and the other. And Egypt has an embassy or all the rest of it. But what did you get back? Every square inch that the Israelis had conquered from Egypt. The whole Sinai Peninsula, which is bigger than Israel. Okay? Now, it was a tricky business. It was President Carter back then and Menachem Begin and Sadat, and they bargained like crazy. And it was like a real Middle East bargaining session, back and forth, forth and back. But at the end of the day, they came to an agreement and they signed a treaty, and both sides have honored it. And Egypt got out of it all their land back, including oil wells and things like this. So no matter how much somebody in Israel, in Egypt today says that Egypt made a mistake making peace with Israel and all the rest of it, that's what they like to say, but they cannot deny that Sadat made a good deal. You cannot deny it. You see? And so that's where they've been. What part of the deal of making that peace treaty with Israel back in 1979 was America promised to give them billions every year just to pay for food. You see, food and basics. And every year, the U.S. gives Israel a couple billion and Egypt a couple billion. You look it up, you'll see. It's public record, right? Every year, they give Israel a couple billion for this, that, and the other, and they give Egypt a couple billion. And without that extra couple billion, they'd sink. What do I mean when I say they'd sink? There wouldn't be enough food for people. There wouldn't be enough shelter. And you'd have riots. And riots get out of hand. And that's what the enemies of the government want. Because Egypt is a funny situation. They used to be a province of the Turkish Empire. But already in the early 1800s, they broke away under Mehmed Ali. And they became sort of like a separate independent country, sort of. And Mehmed Ali was like the king, the Khedive. And let's say the country was there for rule for about 130 years, 140 years, whatever, by this dynasty. Okay? During that time, Egypt went, let's call it capitalist. And so if you made money, you had the life of Riley. But the Hamon Am was very poor and illiterate and, you know, downtrodden and so on and so forth. Combined with that, right? Combined with that, the British took over Egypt in the 1880s and ruled them in one way or another till after the Second World War, till the early 50s. There are tkufas, you know, up to the First World War, and then after the First World War, they signed a certain treaty with Israel, with England that gave them a little bit of independence, a certain amount of independence. But in World War II, let me tell you this, Egypt wanted to join Hitler, and England wouldn't let him. England occupied Egypt, and they fought the Germans, Rommel and El Alamein, from Egypt. And when the Egyptian government was too sympathetic to Hitler, and Sadat, by the way, wrote Hitler love letters. I mean, look it up on the line, you'll see. The British actually intervened, and they invaded the royal palace, and they told the king, put a gun to his head, and they said, either you agree to put in our guy as prime minister who's pro-British or else. And boy, the Egyptians resent that. Down till today, they consider that tremendously humiliating. So the Hamon Am in Egypt, the Egyptian people, had two grievances. They were very, very deep with them. Number one, you're suffering under the capitalist system where a few people have the money and many don't. And number two, no, there's poverty and everything goes along with poverty. And number two, you have foreign control, foreign invaders occupying your country in one degree or another. The last king was King Farouk, and for some reason he hated Israel. He invaded Israel in 1948, but his army wasn't ready, and they pretty much, I can't say they got beaten, because it's not exactly true, but they got beaten. So it was a humiliation for the Egyptian army, even though they fought well. And the Egyptians had never gotten over that either. Okay. Now, the king was overthrown. And all the richy riches were sort of like either kicked out of the country or their money was confiscated by the new regime that started in 1952. And that new regime has been ruling Egypt ever since. So this was what turned out to be Nasser. So it was, listen closely. So it was army officers that did it. Why army officers? They usually come from lower backgrounds and they have the military academy. The West Point gives you a good education, at least good enough, right? Not really great, but good enough. And ever since 1952 till today, so that's what, 73 years now. Is that right? Yeah, 73 years, right? For the last 73 years, it's been the Egyptian Republic, which means there's been a dictatorship of army officers ever since then. Okay, a dictatorship. So the first was Nasser, for Naguib, and then Nasser, until Nasser died. And then afterwards was Sadat, who had been an army officer, a colonel. And after Sadat was killed, you had Mubarak, who had been an Air Force general. And then after Mubarak, we'll talk about it in a second, there was an election, and they put in this guy Morsi for a short time. But then the army moved back and made a coup d'etat, and now you have a general again, which is Sisi. So again, you have Nasser was a military officer, and then Sadat, and then Mubarak, and now Sisi, okay? With a short interruption. That's for 75 years almost, Egypt has been ruled by military dictators. But they don't want to call themselves military dictators. But they seized the power, and they ran the government. And what that means is they controlled the means of coercion. So let's say, for example, you're Nasser. So you had been a colonel, and you were popular with the army, and you appointed the generals, and they supported you. And therefore, anybody tries to knock you out, the army's going to crush them. If somebody wants to make a revolution, the army will come and kill you. They got tanks, they got airplanes, they got all that stuff. You get what I'm saying? He had the military kayak. I'm going to say this for a reason. And in addition to that, Nasser, pretty darn quick, created his own secret police, the Mukhabarat, which has been there till today. So you have like a KGB or a Gestapo or whatever you want to call it. You want to call it a Mossad, it should be called, call whatever you want. But it's a security police. And that means if I'm trying to do something against the government, if the police are doing their job, if the army's doing their job, they'll find me out and they'll arrest me. And like I always say, you know how it works over there in the Middle East. First you're arrested, then you're killed, then you have the trial, and then you're found guilty. You know, that's how it works over there. Okay? And that's what Nasser did. Now, and so have all of his successors. So Egypt is a repressive government, which is trying to hold the lid on 115 million people. That's very hard. As the population grows, it gets harder and harder and harder. This was the problem in Syria, that Assad had a dictatorship, but the same way with the army behind him and the secret police. And they were very, very cruel. And the population grew because Assad encouraged Pru-Urvu, because he wanted to outnumber Israel and then have a war with Israel and succeed. But the Pru-Urvu undid him, because once you have a baby boom, you have a lot of young people. You have young people. Young people are stupid. They don't have caution. And so whereas older people say, if you rush the police, you'll get shot, young people say, we can do it. You know, so we can do it. And what happened in Syria was that the population got so big that the government could not provide jobs for them. So you have a lot of unemployed young people wandering around Vanzir Sakharum. And that's very dangerous from the political point of view, because when you have a lot of young people in the street and here and there hanging on doorsteps and all the rest of it, it's not hard for agitators to come and say, follow me and I'll change everything and your life will change for the better. And you'll have jobs and you'll have a good situation, all the rest of it. Let's just make a revolution. And if a revolution arises, you better have a big army and a big police to shoot a million people. Otherwise, you're going to be overwhelmed. Now, in Syria, he did not do that. Okay? For whatever reason, it didn't happen in Syria. It's partly true that, unlike Egypt, Syria never agreed under any circumstances to make any kind of peace with Israel under Assad Sr. and then under Assad Jr. And because of this, he never got any Western support from America or Europeans and all the rest of it. And there was no way that they're going to get how should I put it, financial aid. So Syria had to make it on its own. And like I said before, they didn't have the type of economy to handle that. And by not joining Egypt and the other countries and trying to cozy up to Israel, Syria made itself disliked. And it's a whole long story, and made itself invulnerable in 2011 to the Arab Spring, which turned out to be that foreign countries like America, I know England did it, and probably Saudi Arabia and Qatar, they do that. They financed the jihadists to go against the Syrian government. So what was going on in Syria from 2011 till recently, was a war between the regime on the one hand, which was, not a jihadist Islamite regime, versus the Muslim warriors. And Syria has a big border with Iraq, so anybody can come in. And eventually, I'm just skipping over a lot of details, they overthrew the government. Okay? Egypt watched this like a hawk. And Egypt said, it's not going to happen over here. What I mean to say is the Egyptian government, the authorities say, we're going to make sure, we'll do all we can to make sure it doesn't happen over here. And what's happened in Egypt is the army officers have been treated with kid gloves. The army has a very big budget. If you're a general or a colonel or something like that, you live a very high lifestyle. You get all the weapons you need, so the army shouldn't feel that it's being cheated or something like that. And anyway, you never know who you use the weapons against. You buy tanks. You might use the tanks against Israel. You might also use the tanks against crowds in Cairo or Alexandria who are trying to rush the government. And the secret police have been built up big, big, big. Okay? And the idea is, if we ever let go and there's an uprising against us, it'll be like in Syria. They'll overthrow the government and they'll kill whoever falls in their hands. So we don't want to get killed. So therefore, we have to make sure we kill them or we keep our foot on their neck. And that's how life is lived in Egypt. Meaning they don't have enough kayach to go to war against Israel. You understand? And they need American support. And because Egypt made a treaty with America, with Israel, they've always had American support ever since the late 70s. And money is money. And America's given them all kind of other sweet deals as well. And the reason America's done it is to encourage the Egyptians to maintain the peace treaty with Israel. And, it is a fact that Israel has not had a major regular war since the Yom Kippur War. I'm talking about an old-fashioned war between two armies, Army A and Army B, as I always say, between the Orioles and the Yankees. That's the kind of war you had in the 48, 56, 67, and 73. It was the Israeli army over here. It was the Arab army, whatever it was over there. You've never had that since. Now, to make matters worse for Syria, they wanted, because of ideology, to and sinna, not to make peace with Israel, but to get rid of Israel. So they always tried to support a certain type of terrorism. They're the total backers of the Hezbollah because Iran sends their stuff through. They got in bed with Iran. And I'm even simplifying, by the way. You see how complicated it is. I'm simplifying. And the Syrians tried to make an A-bomb. I don't know if you remember this, but in 2006 or 2007, Israel did like a raid and it destroyed the A-bomb plant that they had in northeastern Syria. I'm going to talk about that this year, hopefully, in my winter lectures at Shomri and Motzei Shabbos. That's something Israel pulled off. And they try to make poison gas, and they're in bed with North Korea and with China and so on and so forth. Because it is America long ago, part in the time of, was it Bush or Obama, one of the two, they put a, what's the right word? They put a boycott, economic boycott on Syria, the way they have on Iran, and it hurts. So you couldn't do business with Syria, it hurt their economy. So you have expanding population and a shrunken economy. And that led to uprisings and to civil wars. And to the overthrow of the government. In Egypt, they're careful that shouldn't happen. Now, Egypt is different than Syria, and that Syria is a conglomeration of different groups, as you read about in the news. You got the Sunnis, you got the Shiites, you got the Druze, as you know, the Kurds, the Alawites, the Yazidis, the Assyrians, this group, that group. It's like that. It's a bunch of shvatim, because Syria is an artificial country, but the French created it. On the other hand, Egypt is not. Egypt's been around before Avram Avinu, correct? I'll say it again, before Avram Avinu. You see? You know that in the Chumash. So Think about what I just said. So the Egyptians have always been there. They have a very strong national identity, and their geography is such they don't mishtich with other Arab countries. Not really. Not really. And so they've had a unitary kind of structure. So they don't have the kind of sectarian or ethnic kind of things that could tear the country apart the way Syria or Iraq does. That Egypt doesn't have to worry about. On the other hand, who is the ones that overthrew Assad in Syria? The answer is the Muslim Brotherhood of one kind or another. The Muslim Brotherhood is a fanatical organization that started in Egypt in the 1920s by this guy Hassan al-Banna, who was like a high school teacher or something like that. And he said we should go back to living under Islamic halacha, and anything that doesn't conform to that is chayav misa. Okay, it's the Middle East. Okay, and Hassan al-Banna started in the late 20s. It got very popular, big following in Egypt. This threatened the king of Egypt at that time, and they watched him like a hawk. And after the Egyptian army was defeated in the 1948 war by Israel, Hassan al-Banna tried to stir up a whole thing against the king, and so the king killed him. The police shot him. So that means that the Muslim Brotherhood organization, which he started, kind of like a little bit went underground, a little bit not underground, and they had a hand in overthrowing the king in the revolution of 1952, but Nasser grabbed the power from them, because when the king left the country, he was chased out. The question is who should take over, and Nasser was there with the army. He said, we're taking over. And the Muslim Brothers said, but we should take over, and anyway, we helped you and all the rest of it. And Nasser says, I don't want to live in Meisharm. I want to live in Teaneck. That's basically what he said. To live in the Muslim Brotherhood, you have to live in Meisharm. The women have to dress like this. The men have to dress like that. You have to follow this law and that law. If you're not, you're Chai Misa. You get Malkus. You have the whole Sharia law. You have slavery. You have everything that goes along with the traditional Islamic idea, which is what the jihadists want to do across the world today. And Nasser said, I don't want to do that. If you ever look at pictures of Nasser, I always say he lives in Teaneck. He wasn't, by that I mean, he wasn't from Muslim. He really was. And he davened 5 times a day, and he really did. And he meant it. But he dressed in a Western suit. His wife didn't cover her hair. His daughters went to college. You know, that sort of thing. So, and he would say like this, I'm Orthodox Muslim. Okay? And so they hated each other. And they tried to kill him several times. They shot him in 1954 or something like that. Tried to kill him several times. In the 50s and 60s, Nasser was sufficiently charismatic that he could counter the Muslim Brotherhood. Although they did try to kill him a bunch of times, and they did try ceaselessly to infiltrate the army and the police and all the rest of it, which led to him hanging the leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood, especially, what was the guy's name? Al-Qutb, Sayyid Al-Qutb, that some guy who was almost like a fanatical, you know, he was in America for a while and he got turned off. It's too priestistic. And he really said you should overthrow the government and set up an Islamic state here. So they want to do in Egypt what Khomeini, so to speak, did in Iran. That's what they want to do. Set up a Sunni state instead of a Shiite state and be strictly religious and all that sort of thing. But that means they'll kill everybody else, because that's what Khomeini did in Iran. They'll kill everybody connected with the Shah. So in Egypt, they know that. And even when Nasser died, the army and the people in charge said, we're not going to let the Muslim Brotherhood take over. We're putting in Sadat. And after him, and the Muslim Brotherhood shot Sadat in 82 after he signed the treaty. And the army and the police again put in Mubarak. Yeah, it's all one mafia. It's all one khevra, you see? And under Mubarak also, it was constantly seething. And what the Egyptian regime had to do was set up a big, elaborate snitch system and, a security system, which means use all your high tech to watch everybody as much as you can. And everybody's on the payroll to inform them and everybody else. That's how you do it, by the way. That's how it works. And if anybody ever says something against the regime, you know, like I said before, you're going to disappear. Now, in 2011, there was the Arab Spring. And the mobs came there, and they sort of like overthrew, they forced Mubarak out. They didn't, it was tricky, because then you had elections for the first time, and Morsi won. Morsi was the candidate of the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, why did the army let him run? They didn't want to, but he promised he wouldn't take the come on anybody or anything like this, and he'll follow the rules of the Constitution. But it didn't work out, and they didn't trust him. And I don't think he meant a word of it, Morsi. He, as a from Muslim brother guy, he wanted, number one, to slowly but surely gain power and kick out the army guys, put in his own guys, and then go to war with Israel. Okay? Because as a from Muslim, that's naturally what he wanted to do. Israel was tittering. In 2015, I think it was, the army overthrew, made a coup d'etat, and they arrested Morsi, who died in jail. I'm sure he died from natural causes. He got a cold or something like that. Got out of hand, what a bummer. And they go after the Muslim Brotherhood guys because what they're saying is like this. Don't tell me I'm cruel on you. You'll be twice as cruel on me if you ever get power. Therefore, whatever I do against you is justified. They have to spend so much time and effort controlling their own gigantic movement of people want to overthrow them. They don't have time to fight Israel. You know? So I can't say that the Treaty of 1975 was such a brilliant work of diplomacy and it worked out that Israel and Egypt both benefited from it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's that events have so come together in Egypt that it's you know, the mortal threat to the Egyptian government is not Israel. Everybody knows that. Israel not a threat to Egypt. Yeah, right? It's the Muslim Brotherhood and their various permutations. So Al-Qaeda is a part of Muslim Brotherhood. I don't know, you know, all this, all that, all the different groups that they have over there. Al-Nusra Front, HTS, the ones who took over now in Syria, is all part of Muslim Brotherhood. And my friends, Hamas is Muslim Brotherhood. In other words, the Palestinian branch of the Muslim Brotherhood, who would like to take over, rule, kick out the Jews or kill them, rule all of Palestine as an Arab state. It would be a fundamentalist Arab state in which if you don't follow all the rules of Islam, you'll suffer. They'll punish you badly and kill you and all kind of torture you and so on and so forth, which they were doing to the degree possible in Gaza. You understand? So in other words, if the Hamas, for example, the Mashal, would win in Israel, they would kill the Jews, just like they're trying to do in Syria. The Jews in Israel, I mean. You get it? To give one example. So this is how the Middle East runs. So you have a funny situation. You have General Sisi running the regime in Egypt. You have a war between Israel and the Gaza Strip. The people in the Gaza Strip obviously hate Israel, but they also hate the government in Egypt. They want to overthrow the government of Egypt and it should be replaced by a Muslim Brotherhood state. And then it'll be Gan Eden for Hamas because that state will sympathize with Gaza, of course, and give them material aid, and Israel won't be able to fight them. It'll be too many. In other words, if you want to see an example of Chesed, Sha'asalana, Kadosh Baruch Hu, I mean this. The government in Egypt is not the Muslim Brotherhood. The government in Egypt is bitterly opposed to the Muslim Brotherhood because the Muslim Brotherhood, if they took over Egypt, would kill them. And then they would go after Israel. So, Balkarcho, Shalobatavasam, they have to cooperate with Israel without looking too much like they're cooperating with Israel. And that's why, de facto, they have closed the border of Gaza, right? They closed the border of Gaza. And, how should I put it? They have kept other Arab jihadists from traveling to join Hamas to fight Israel by getting through Egypt. That's why they closed the border. They've, at least as far as I can tell, since the war, don't let weapons in, as far as I can see. I know they had that tunnel and all this stuff. And de facto, they're like a friend of Israel, even though they hate Israel. And the head of Hamas said this the other day, and people were angry at him, but he wasn't telling the false. And one of the big miscalculations, which every war has miscalculations, that's a rule. One of the big miscalculations, as I've said a dozen times, was, I mean, really a dozen times, Hamas thought when they attack Israel, especially if they gain any success, Haba Bator, everybody should join us, and we'll have a 10-pronged attack. Jordan will attack, the West Bank will attack Israel, Egypt will attack Israel, Lebanon, Hezbollah, Assad, Iran, and more, right? Al-Qaeda and so on and so forth. And Israel will go down under too many heavy blows. But it didn't turn out that way. Nobody really joined Hamas after October 7th, even though the Hezbollah sent some rockets or something like that. But that's not real. I'm talking about in the military sense, okay? And so the Israeli army has had a free hand, if you want to be honest about it, to concentrate their efforts against Hamas. Otherwise, they'd be a much bigger problem to deal with. I don't know if Israel could deal with that. You understand? I don't know if they could deal with that. So, I mean, God forbid. And so Hamas is really angry, and that's why they say Egypt is de facto the friend of Israel. And because of circumstance I just described, they kind of are, meaning they hate Israel, but for realistic purposes, they don't want Hamas to win. If Hamas won, then Hamas would encourage the Muslim Brotherhood guys in Egypt to overthrow the government of Egypt. And so they all sit at the table and smile with each other at the Arab League meetings, but each one has a dagger trying to stick in the other guy's back. That's how it works in the Arab world, which is, you know, to the plus of Israel, I suppose, because their enemies are at least divided. So today you have a very funny situation. The certain actors, and I don't know who the countries are exactly, are, I noticed on the internet, putting out a lot of news stories, like Qatar, you know, because Al Jazeera is Qatar. And they're saying, oh, Egypt is a repressive dictatorship. And oh, Egypt is blocking its people from joining the fight. And Egypt's doing this, that, and the other. And they're trying, it's pretty clear to me, to encourage an uprising in Egypt. Now, and who's favoring this? The answer is from Muslims, the Muslim Brotherhood. Qatar bankrolls the Muslim Brotherhood. That's how it goes, right? Saudi Arabia, I don't think so. But it seems that Saudi Arabia is also criticizing Egypt. So you have certain bad actors out there. Maybe it's spy intelligence services of different countries. I'm very serious. And it looks like they have some vested interest in overthrowing the Egyptian regime. For Israel, this regime that you have right now, as bad as it is the best you're ever going to get. There won't be anything better. There will never be in Egypt a country that says, let's be friends with Israel. That ain't how it rolls. The sinah and the hatred they have for Israel is beyond belief. You think I'm just saying it's for, you know, rhetorical. Just take my word for it, or don't, as you choose. But they hate Israel, my goodness, right? They hate them, they hate them, they hate them. But circumstances are such that they have to follow policy that de facto, although they'll never admit it, comes out to be benefit for Israel. So if Israel wins this war, halavai, if they win this war and they finish off Hamas, double halavai, a major reason will be because Egypt was cooperating. You understand? Now, Egypt would love it if Israel would wipe out Hamas. Then Egypt, I think, would then want to support the PLO, you know, the regular Palestinians, and push for them to have their state and all this kind of stuff, and then work against Israel from that basis, provided that the state wasn't taken over by other from Muslim Brotherhood types who would then be looking for a Palestinian movement to help overthrow the Egyptian government by encouraging the rebels inside Egypt itself. Now, the truth is, how long can this last? The population goes from 30 million to 60 to 90 to now 120 almost, and 150. It's so many people. How are you going to keep them down on the farm? Well, if you use modern technology, you can do it. And you use drones, and you know, and you listen to everybody's phone, and you follow everybody's internet. I don't know how you do it, but it's possible to do it. They do it in Russia and China and places like that. It's possible to do it. So Egypt has to take a lot of its energy and put into that. It could be that even with that foreign help, you'll have starvation or whatever in Egypt one day. I think there was an economic crisis last year and they had to devalue the Egyptian money. The upper class lives the life of Riley. And if you're an army officer or a relative of an army officer or a friend, you live very well. If you're Hamun Am, you don't. And how do you translate the dissatisfaction, the Hamun Am, into revolution? That you need leadership, you need organization, you need communications. And the Egyptian government will do whatever it can to prevent that from happening. So we have a funny situation in which outside actors like Qatar and certain groups in the Saudi Arabia, I don't understand why, and now the people, I'm sure, in Syria are going to be like that. Jelani, if he's able to stabilize, he'll try to move his type of guys or their counterparts to take over the government in Egypt. And then you'll have like a double situation. Israel have a fundamentalist Arab state on the north in Syria, and a fundamentalist Arab state in the south, and they'll be crunched in the middle. That'll be the Akhtar Tsars. So It's funny. This guy, Sisi, like I said before, hates Israel. My goodness, my goodness. But by dint of circumstances, politics makes strange bedfellows, and he's compelled to be, so to speak, act in a way that boils down to be friendly towards Israel. This is why you read in the papers all the time that Egypt is one of the mediators, you understand, over the hostage crisis. Nothing has worked yet, but Egypt is interested that they should be looking to play that kind of a role, you know, and be sort of like an honest interlocutor, because on the one hand, they are Muslim. On the other hand, they hate the Muslim Brotherhood. They hate the Hamas. They also hate Israel. So to me, it's interesting. I'm going to be a mediator between Reuven and Shimon. I hate Reuven like anything, and I hate Shimon worse. It's only in the Middle East could you come with such a mishigas. So as far as I know, and that's all I can ever share with you, obviously, as far as I know, you have to daven that the current regime in Egypt should stay in power, because if they're replaced by their enemies, Israel will be in a much, much worse shape than they are right now, chas v'chalila. And anyway, I just wanted to share those thoughts. Keep this in mind when you go online. If you ever see something negative about Egypt, always ask yourself, who is it that's putting it out there? And what are they interested in? And don't think if they get rid of the government in Egypt, it's going to be an American democracy like Thomas Jefferson. No, it'll be a Khomeini-type situation, except in Sunni Islam. And one of the first things on their target will be Israel, which I hope not. Anyway, I hope I didn't get too complicated over here, but I just want to share those thoughts. Again, I want to thank the Lowensteins and Brad and Brachy Kaufman for sponsoring. With that, I wish you all a good day.